Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news. Stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. It's the show where we don't take calls. We don't take... No, what don't we take? We don't tolerate sponsors. We don't take calls. But we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought, and it's so good to have you back for another week as we turn the switch here in Colorado from summer to fall in one weekend. Every year, Labor Day comes along, and it's as if the Lord turns a great big switch from summer to fall. And so here we are, but we are enjoying ourselves out here as we look at the events of the week through the lens of original thought. Original thought, by the way, as recorded in the scriptures, the Holy Bible, the from the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If you want me to put a fine point on it, there you go. Lots of interesting stuff happening this week. I happened to catch Chris Christie on television during this past week, and he was hysterically calling for help from the federal government because of inland flooding from Hurricane Irene. And I was just flipping through the news channels, and here's Chris Christie sitting there saying, "We need help now." And I'm thinking, this is conservatism? This is modern conservatism? Our one of our biggest conservative leaders, and I mean that in every sense of the word, Chris Christie, one of our biggest conservative leaders, hysterically yelling for help from the federal government in the wake of some flooding. It's just frankly embarrassing for the conservative movement, and I just don't know if Chris Christie fits with the... Well, that statement didn't fit, that's for sure. I would have loved to see Chris Christie stand up and say, "Leave us alone! We're New Jerseyans, we can take care of ourselves." Do they go by New Jerseyan or New Jerseyite?
New Jerser.
New Jerser? New Jerseyer? I'm not sure. But that was pretty sad to see Chris Christie break down like that and beg for help from the feds. What's that?
New Jerseyan.
New Jerseyan? New Jerseyan. I'm not sure. But, yeah, Chris, that's not conservatism, please. Would you please get a hold of yourself? Anyway, let's move on to the news of the day. Did anything interesting happen? Oh, I got a funny story for all of you out there who have rental properties. I have one of the funniest and saddest tenant stories in the history of rentals. We have a tenant in a small condo that we own with a business partner. A business partner, I always have to tell everyone these days. You know, in the past, I could have just said, you know, me and my partner, we bought this condo a few years ago. But now that has a double entendre, meaning like a partner. So I have to tell them that I own this condo with my business partner, who is a man, who does not live with me, and we have no romantic interest in one another at all. We happen to own a condo together. It's an investment, business partners. My tenant calls me at the beginning of last week. She says, "Doug, I have reconciled with my husband. I'm moving out as soon as possible, moving back in with him." I said, "That's great news. Praise the Lord. That's awesome." She starts packing up her stuff. I put up a Craigslist ad. I get a bite. And within 48 hours, I've got a signed lease and a deposit. All I've got to do is bring the new tenant back by for a second peek with her high school boys to make sure they approve of the property. Well, I took her over there. And the current tenant was not home. And she said, "Doug, be sure not to let the dog out." And so I kept the dog in. The dog got a little freaked out, I must confess. And as the potential tenant was strolling through the main floor, the current tenant's dog, is there a way to put this politely? Relieved himself on the carpet right in front of the potential new tenant. At which point she bolted so fast, I had to call her on the cell phone. "Where'd you go?" Anyway, her husband called me and said, she wants out. She doesn't want the place. And I gave them their money back, and I ended up with no tenant for the month of September. But things are looking up for October, so don't worry about us here at the McBurney compound. But, yeah, she pointed at the spot on the rug, and she said, "Did you see the dog peed?" I said, "Well, that's life." And she bolted out the door. Anyway, it was quite amusing. But there's bigger news, important news this week that we need to get to. So let's start from ABC in Oakland, California, reported this past week that Green Day frontman Billy Joe Armstrong was kicked off a Southwest Airlines flight for wearing his pants too low. Yeah. Armstrong, who is a 36-year-old white man, was approached by a flight attendant and told to pull his pants up. He initially dismissed the request, according to ABC. When the flight attendant repeated the request and threatened to have Armstrong removed from the plane, Armstrong replied, "I'm just trying to get my blanking seat." But he said it with that nasal thing they have. He always sounds like he just snorted a great big line of cocaine or something. "I'm just trying to get my blanking seat." Anyway, Armstrong and the person he was traveling with were then removed from the flight. Now, this could be all just be a Twitter hoax, because this has all been released through his Twitter feed, apparently. And Southwest responded quickly with a Twitter feed of their own, a tweet, I believe they're called, a tweet of their own. Southwest Airlines said, quote, "Very sorry for your experience. Someone from our customer relations team will reach out to you with more details and perhaps a belt. First to whip you with, and second to pull your pants up." Okay. Green Day. Yeah. I hope you save some pennies, boys, because it's a short ride. All right. So there you have it from the pop. That's from our pop culture file.
He's a Hecubus, isn't he?
He does look like Hecubus. He looks like a spawn of Satan. And he only knows three chords, and hey, he's got a music career. So what does that say about the pop culture?
Like
ACDC. All right. Now, a bigger story out of Florida. From Reuters, a Florida lawmaker is welcoming students back to school by handing out 200 leather belts to help them comply with a new state law that bans saggy pants on government school campuses. That's right. Democratic State Senator Gary Siplin of Orlando pushed for 6 years for the so-called pull-up-your-pants law. I'm sorry. It's the pull-your-pants-up law. And he finally got his wish last spring when Florida lawmakers passed the pull-your-pants-up law. The state legislature voted overwhelmingly to enact the ban on baggy pants at the start of this school year, making Florida and Arkansas the only two states with such a widespread prohibition against saggy pants for students. This Democratic State Senator Gary Siplin handed out a dozen belts donated by a local church to students who showed up with droopy drawers at Oak Ridge High School in Orlando, and he left another 25 belts with school administrators to hand out as needed. So here's where we've come, ladies and gentlemen. In a day and age when school teachers definitely need belts, they just don't know what to do with them. They just tentatively hand them to students and ask them to pull their pants up. So this is an idea that has come to fruition as a law now, and now it's being clouded by the man who authored the law. It's being clouded by the welfare mentality. In true Democrat fashion, he's giving them the belts for free. Instead of having them do some work and earn the money to buy some belts, he's handing out belts for free, further building up in the minds of these children the entitlement mentality. Well, if you want my pants up, you got to give me a belt. I must deserve a belt.
How about rope?
Yeah, how about giving them rope?
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Use the belt for whipping.
Yeah, use the belt for whipping and use the rope to hold their pants up. Oh, my goodness. And we've got modern-day mainline evangelical churches donating belts to the cause, further entrenching this entitlement mentality amongst these moronic children. Anyway, is there anything else? Municipalities around the country, according to the Reuters article, have enacted their own laws barring saggy pants, and many individual school dress codes already ban fashions that leave certain body parts exposed.
What?
Yeah, so that's the state of government education. Both the students and the administration just completely adrift in a sea of amorality, drifting into a vortex of immorality. And so, hence we here at the McBurney compound, we homeschool our children. And we'll never allow the government to get their hooks into them if we can possibly avoid it. And I guess we'll have to see about that since they're putting their hooks in just about everything. All right. Now, some news from the Culture File. This is out of Houston, Texas. A shocking story. A woman made an initial court appearance last week on a charge of tampering with evidence. Tampering with evidence, I said. Prosecutors allege that she took her daughter to a Cleveland clinic where she had an abortion on October 22nd. The 19-year-old son was indicted earlier this year on three counts of aggravated sexual assault of a child under 14 years old. During an interview with investigators back in December, the girl, who has moderate mental retardation, said that her brother, the one indicted on aggravated sexual assault charges, said her brother assaulted her in March of 2010 and on several other occasions. Authorities say the mother knew of the investigation in the case, and she attempted to conceal evidence. Evidence in this case being the fetus, which they call here biological evidence, by taking the daughter to have an abortion in Ohio. So the evidence, that's the person that was killed, would not be available for the investigation. Investigators say they did recover the fetus. The girl was about 22 weeks pregnant at the time, which means that the baby had all 10 fingers, all 10 toes, had a heartbeat, blinked, laughed, smiled, played with her fingers and toes in the womb before this biological evidence was brutally murdered. The 50-year-old mother had tried getting an abortion a week earlier for her daughter, but her daughter became so hysterical at the time that she couldn't go through with it. That was a week prior. You know, this is the real face of reproductive choice, ladies and gentlemen. Young women being coerced to kill their children. Only most other times, it's a man that is coercing the woman to kill her baby. And if you doubt that's the fact, go stand outside any Planned Parenthood on a day when they're killing children, and you'll see women being practically pulled into Planned Parenthood, typically by a man. So welcome to reproductive choice, ladies. If this represents freedom, I don't think you know what freedom is. It's the freedom for men to coerce women into legally murdering their children. That's what the feminist movement has given us. The lawyer for the boy involved, the 19-year-old son, said that the mother, as a concerned parent, had every right to seek an abortion for her daughter, whom she believed would not be capable of taking care of an infant. So the lesson she taught to her children was, if you're not prepared to take care of someone, it's okay to kill them. That's the lesson. That's the takeaway here for the youngsters involved in this story. The girl's family, by the way, including this 50-year-old alleged mother, relinquished their parental rights earlier this month, and the girl now remains in foster care. So, that's all there is to that. Pretty depressing. And by the way, that's in Texas, which so many conservatives see as the last great hope for America. I'm beginning to have my doubts. Just a terrible story. I've got another sad story here from the Personhood File. From WorldNet Daily, advocates for an allegedly pro-life law captured a victory, so-called, in the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals last week, where judges ruled the state of South Dakota can require abortionists to provide specific warnings to patients about just exactly what an abortion is and does. And so the abortion regulators, who believe we should keep the killing of innocent people legal, simply regulate it properly. They're celebrating. The court found constitutional the state's decision to demand abortionists tell patients three things. And here they are. You must tell the patient that the abortion will terminate the life of a whole separate, unique, living human being. And then you can kill the baby. You must tell the patient that the patient has an existing relationship with that unborn human being, and that the relationship enjoys protection under the United States Constitution and under the laws of South Dakota, and then you can kill the baby. You must tell the patient that by having an abortion, her existing relationship and her existing constitutional rights with regards to that relationship will be terminated, and then you can kill the baby. This is what is currently celebrated as a victory by the alleged pro-life movement in the formerly great state of South Dakota. This is no victory. This is no victory indeed. WorldNet Daily tells us that the law was the first of several huge battles in the state of South Dakota and its pro-life community. Their pro-life community have launched in their war against the Roe versus Wade decision that authorized legal abortions throughout the nation. Starting in 1973, this informed consent law was adopted in 2005. The law also requires abortionists to refer patients to a counseling center and affirm that they have had that counseling, and then you can kill the baby. Yeah, it's a sad, sad story. The abortion regulators, their last gasp in the pro-life movement. I find it ironic that pro-lifers in South Dakota think they've launched this latest attack in the war against the Roe versus Wade decision, when in reality, if Roe versus Wade is overturned, this informed consent law will keep the murder of children legal in South Dakota. Preach it, Stevie. We can't give up now. Say it again, brother. It's the Weekly Worldview, and I am Doug McBurney, and so good to have you back. We go right from that story into the domestic tranquility file. I'm afraid it doesn't get much better, ladies and gentlemen. From Lake Worth, Florida, the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office reports that a deputy served 48-year-old Juan Ramon De Jesus Martinez with a restraining order last Tuesday afternoon. It had been requested by his ex-wife, 55-year-old Martha Aguilar. A half hour later, Aguilar was found dead behind a Lake Worth business. Witnesses report seeing De Jesus running from the area. De Jesus was eventually found shot dead inside his parked car near his apartment, an apparent murder-suicide. The couple had two children, ages 17 to 19, and that's just one of the murder-suicides that occurred this week. If we decided to cover them all, they would take up the entire broadcast hour. And so that's just a sampling of the state of domestic tranquility here in the lower 48. I'm trying to see if there's something amusing that I could go to, because it's been kind of a downer here. Well, here we go. This might cheer you up. This is from NBC. Solyndra, a major manufacturer of solar technology, that was touted by the Obama administration as a prime example of how green technology could deliver jobs and was awarded federal government loans, low-cost loans, of $535 million from the Department of Energy, has shut its doors and declared bankruptcy. Okay, maybe that's kind of a bummer, too, but it's kind of funny, except, well, it's kind of funny in that we conservatives have been telling you heathen, pagan, moron, unwashed, slimy, filthy heathens, liberals, for a generation that the whole idea of green energy is ridiculous. It's ludicrous on its face. And we shouldn't be pumping money into companies that are producing energy, so-called energy-delivering products that actually consume more energy than they deliver. We've been saying this, and now here's the proof right in your face. But there's a bigger question here. Where is the money? Did they borrow the $535 million? That's something that hasn't been made clear to me. I know they had the low-cost loan guarantees from the Department of Energy, but did they borrow that $500 million? And if so, where is it? Could it be in the coffers of the DNC for the 2012 election? I think it very well might be. I'm not making any accusations. I'm just raising a legitimate question. Where did all the money go? Because I've seen some companies burn through some money, but $500 million, I mean, you would have to be pretty grossly negligent to burn through $500 million in less than 2 years and then go bankrupt. I have a feeling something happened to this money that's nefarious. And maybe we'll find out, but probably not, because the MedStream media is not going to investigate the case, in my opinion. It will not be investigated, and the money will just have vanished, I suppose. All right. Now, here's another scandal. That could be a scandal, if anyone tried to pay attention, bothered to pay attention. Here's something that is a scandal. People are beginning to pay attention, and there was a seismic event that occurred within the Obama administration this past week that if you weren't paying attention to the news, you might have missed the 20-second clip that made it onto the national airways. A seismic event within the Obama administration, and here you go, from Fox News. Just hours after the death of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry, federal officials tried to cover up evidence that the gun that killed Terry was one of the guns the government intentionally helped sell to the Mexican cartels in a weapons trafficking program that we've come to know popularly as Operation Fast and Furious. Now, Congress has now renewed its demand for more answers in the Fast and Furious scandal. 21 more Fast and Furious guns have been found at violent crime scenes in Mexico. That's up from 11 that the agency had admitted just last month. Representative Daryl Issa and Grassley, Republicans, are expanding their investigation into the scandal. The new U.S. Attorney for Arizona, the chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, have requested interviews, emails, memos, and even handwritten notes from members of the U.S. Attorney's Office that played key roles in the ATF program, Fast and Furious. And the ATF, the chief of the ATF, resigned this past week. And like I say, if you weren't paying attention, you missed it. But that's a pretty big event, that the head of the ATF has stepped down after he was pretty much thrown under the bus by members of the administration. And perhaps now he may feel a little bit more motivated to tell the truth about what's going on here. But I have a feeling that it could be a problem for the president. If unemployment is above 9% in the spring, or if Hillary declares her candidacy, the MedStream media may suddenly find this story interesting. And they may want to go talk to the former head of the ATF and get his side of the story. Yeah. But we'll see about that. Because Barry has lots of friends in the media. They all seem to operate off the same page. And I just don't know. I think that this scandal would have already erupted like a volcano For any other president, Democrat or Republican, but for some reason Obama is somehow bulletproof when it comes to...
You're the one who sets the bar, the hairdo king, the fashions are. You're fabulous.
I'm fabulous.
You're fabulous.
Oh, I'm fabulous.
You're the one we all can't see. It's all about you.
It's all about me.
You're fabulous.
I'm fabulous.
You're fabulous.
I'm fabulous.
Yeah, Barry, we couldn't agree more. You're so fabulous that you can run guns into Mexico and get federal agents killed and have people resign, lose their careers, and it just never seems to make it to your desk. Truly a political magician, Barry is. But there are cracks beginning to show in the facade of the Barry Ho administration. A few cracks. And this next story is a true barometer of where the pop culture is regarding Barry Ho. This is from a website that's devoted to NASCAR. I guess it's called SB Nation. I'm not sure. SB Nation. SBNation.com. Not a big NASCAR fan, so not that I dislike NASCAR. I like auto racing. And I have watched some NASCAR races, and they've been quite exciting. Exhilarating, even. And I wouldn't mind going to one someday. But here's the story. From SBNation.com, President Barry Ho will honor NASCAR champion Jimmy Johnson and the 11 other drivers from last year in a White House ceremony this coming week. But nearly half of the 2010 playoff contenders from NASCAR will not be there. Yeah, five drivers. Greg Biffle, Kurt Busch, Carl Edwards, Kevin Harvick, and Tony Stewart will not be attending the White House event due to scheduling conflicts. Yeah, that's got to be a pretty big scheduling conflict when you blow off the President of the United States. But then again, when the President is in a complete meltdown, perhaps these NASCAR drivers are smart enough to know that, first of all, Barry Ho doesn't appeal to their demographic. No. NASCAR fans are generally not standing up waving the flag when Barry Ho's motorcade, or that big black bus capsule thing he's driving around, they're not standing up waving the flag and saluting when Barry drives by. So Greg Biffle, Kurt Busch, Carl Edwards, Kevin Harvick, and Tony Stewart are smart enough to know that maybe getting their picture taken with Barack Hussein Obama is not going to help their NASCAR careers in any way. Now, this article I'm reading is an editorial, and here's what the editorialist Jeff Gluck, yeah, sounds like he writes for a NASCAR website. Jeff Gluck says, for a sport that prides itself on patriotism, having so many drivers turn down the president's invitation simply seems strange. It does seem strange, but when the president's not a patriot, and you want to appear patriotic, perhaps you snub the president, thereby establishing your credentials as a patriot by not hanging out with an un-American president. An un-American, anti-patriotic, anti-American, anti-Constitution, anti-life, anti-everything good and wholesome that made America great, Barry Ho. They just don't want to be seen with him. Now, for all you NASCAR fans out there, I do want to make you aware that Jimmy Johnson, Danny Hamlin, Jeff Gordon, Kyle Busch, Clint Bowyer, Jeff Burton, and Matt Kenseth will attend the Ho event at the White House. So you want to make sure you note who blew off the unpatriotic president and who knuckled under and decided to go for the photo op with the worst president in the history of the United States of America. Anyway, probably not a good move for those guys. But it should be fun to watch. I guess we'll have to see as the week goes by how many of the five knuckle under and decide to go. Because, you know, there's going to be some political pressure exerted by the Democrat political machine to make sure that these drivers don't diss the president and that they show up. And by the way, for all you NASCAR fans, diss is an urban colloquialism that means to disrespect someone. Just want to bring our NASCAR listeners up to speed there. Okay. And we've got another story regarding the Ho administration. From the Palm Beach Post, in a torrent of official communications during the approach and aftermath of Hurricane Irene, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has repeatedly used the phrase federal family when describing the Ho administration's response to the storm. The Ho administration didn't invent the phrase, but it has taken it to new heights. Under the direction of President Obama and Secretary of State Janet Napolitano, this is a quote, by the way, of a message sent out as the storm gathered strength. Under the direction of President Ho and Secretary Jack Napolitano, the entire federal family is leaning forward to support our state, to support our state, tribal, and territorial partners along the East Coast. That was a FEMA news release from last Friday. Apparently, the word government has been nearly banished, according to the Palm Beach Post, with FEMA instead referring to federal, state, and local partners, as well as offices and personnel and family. Yeah, it's no longer the government. It's just we're like members of your family. We're here to help. Florida State University communications professor David Hawk says, quote, government is such a dirty word right now. Part of what the federal government does and any elected official does is change the terms of the language game into terms that are favorable to them. Okay, first of all, if you are a communications professor, Dr. Huck, that means you were the dumbest kid in your high school class who got to go on to college. Yeah, that's how you become a communications major, let alone a communications professor. Too stupid to work in the real sciences. Couldn't quite cut it in biology. Electrical engineering was a little bit above my head, but communications, that's where he made his mark. Anyway, he's a professor, and he says elected officials change the terms of the language game. The language game? What is that? The language game. I mean, you and I don't know what it is, but I think elected officials and pollsters and politicos, they must know what the language game is. You and I, we call that speaking to one another. Or making a statement, or saying something. But in this world, that's the language game, and you have to change the terms to terms that are favorable to you. Yeah, so, and hence the federal family. So the phrase federal family has been used in connection with FEMA at least as far back as 1999, all the way back into the disastrous Bill Clinton administration. Now, under President George W. Bush, FEMA officials sprinkled the alliterative euphemism into congressional testimony and statements. When former FEMA director Michael Brown, who now hosts an unlistenable radio show here in Denver, Colorado, you would not believe this guy has a gig on the radio. It is unbelievable. You remember Brownie from the whole Katrina thing? He's on the radio in Denver. Now, they did put him on a slot at like 2 in the morning, but I've heard the guy. Unlistenable. Anyway, Michael Brown, back during the Bush administration, promised to help hurricane-battered Floridians in 2004. He vowed that the federal family is dedicated to staying for as long as it takes. Now, Michael Brown pawns himself off as a conservative on the radio. Yet he's a part of the whole federal family. We're here to help. We'd like to put you on welfare for the rest of your natural life. All right, I got to get here. This microphone is jumping out and doing weird things on me. I apologize if you heard that popping noise. All right. Well, there's more from this story. I got to go further here because according to the Palm Beach Post, during the Clinton administration, Vice President Al Gore responded to 1999 flooding in Iowa by pledging that the federal family is committed to providing the necessary resources to comfort every person,
and family devastated by this disaster, and to help them return to their normal way of living as fast as possible, and hopefully with a big government check so that you'll be reliant on us until the day you die, which we might be able to decide, seeing as you are now a possession of the United States government. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be your federal strange uncle. Some of that at the end was not actually a part of Mr. Gore's statement, but you know what I mean. Now, a Google search shows that shows the phrase appearing 10 times on FEMA's website during the Bush years. Since Obama took office, federal family has turned up 118 times on FEMA.gov. Now, for all you Rush clones out there, Rush bots, this does not mean that Bush was good. It simply means that Barry Ho is 10 times worse than Bush, and Bush was a complete disaster. Bush took conservatism down into the depths of liberalism and somehow convinced people he was a conservative. I don't know how he pulled this off. I don't know how George Bush made Janine Garofalo so angry at him. He was a flaming liberal and 10 times worse than Obama. I'm sorry, Obama is 10 times worse than Bush. But a note to Limbaugh, Hannity, Levin, all of you, that doesn't mean that Bush was good. He was bad. Let's see now. Now this, the communication professor, speaks up one more time in the article. He says, quote, "If FEMA can come in and really do a great job, maybe that federal family thing would stick with the people on the ground." We're the federal family and we're dedicated to put America on welfare one disaster at a time. Thank you very much. Unbelievable. We've got Chris Christie begging for help from the feds. And we've got the federal family started by Clinton, but continued by Bush. And this is the state of conservatism in America. Conservatism has become liberal. Yeah, so where do you go from there? Where do you turn? Is there anywhere to turn? There's one place to turn, and that's the source of all wisdom. And that's the Bible, in which there are clearly laid out parameters for a righteous government and a righteous justice system. But I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, that we cannot count on returning to the Republicans anymore. Can't turn to them, no. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to burst your bubble, but that's where it's at. All right, now, let's move on into the politics file. We got a lot from the politics file this week. From the Chicago Tribune, Thomas Villanova last worked for the city of Chicago in 1989 as an electrical mechanic with the Department of Streets and Sanitation, making about $40,000 a year. Yet in 2008, he was allowed to retire at age 56 with a $108,000 a year city pension. And that's because, according to the Tribune, under a little-known state law, his pension was based not on his city paycheck, but on the much larger salary he received as a union official. That's right. Now, the article, the Tribune, goes on to tell us that this kind of deal is available only to union officials. Not surprising there. That's pretty good, a $40,000 a year job, and you walk away with a $108,000 a year pension. That sounds like a union-type thing. I'm not surprised. And it sounds very Chicago. All you folks in Chicago, congratulations for perpetuating the stereotype that everyone in your government is a criminal. We really appreciate, because we kind of already thought that, and then we see articles like this, and it just it helps us to know that we are dealing with reality, that we are sentient. We are paying attention. You're all a bunch of crooks up there in the Chicago machine. Now, Mr. Villanova is just 58 years old, and he stands to collect approximately $3 million from the city's municipal pension fund during his lifetime. In order to receive an inflated city pension, here's how you do it in Chicago, just in case you're not sure. State law says labor leaders can't be part of any pension plan from their union, yet Villanova is one of four officials who receive city pensions based on their union salaries, even though they never gave up their union pensions. So he's probably collecting 30 grand a year on that $40,000 job. Maybe that's all part of the $108,000. Oh, no, wait a minute. It's $198,000 annual salary. Ooh. Oh, no, that was what he made. He made $198,000 to represent city workers with the union, and now he walks away with a measly $108,000 pension, and he's 58 years old. I'm not sure he'll be able to take enough cruises or buy enough cars to spend all that money, but, well, being there in Chicago, I'm sure he has a lot of associates who will instruct him on how to properly spend the hard-earned money of the citizens there in Chicago. Terrence Stefanski, executive director of the Municipal Employees Annuity and Benefit Fund of Chicago, conceded that the union leaders violated state law. But, he said, the law is confusing, and the city pension fund isn't in a position to determine whether labor leaders knowingly submitted false information. I mean, that would be a felony, and it could just get all... Why do we want to even get into all that? We're all part of the family here in Chicago. We take care of one another here in Chicago. That's right. You get in with the union, you got it made for life, brother. That's right. So there you have Chicago. Not surprising. Not sure what my pension is in line to be here at the... do we have a pension plan? Don't really have a plan, do we? Should have took that union job like my uncle told me. Doug, you got to take a union job, man. Learn a trade and take a union job. Take care of yourself. Anyway, should have moved to Chicago. Join the union. All right, so more from the politics file. We just learned about tax dollars diverted into the pocket of a fairly young retiring union labor leader there in Chicago. Tax dollars being... being misspent there. Let's go to Washington, D.C. This is from the Washington, D.C. Examiner, the Washington Examiner. A Washington, D.C. HIV AIDS service provider has been at, first of all, what's an HIV AIDS service provider? I mean, is that like a prostitute in Copenhagen? I mean, is that like a government, is that like an officially sanctioned? Anyway, let's leave that aside. This HIV/AIDS service provider has been accused of spending nearly $330,000 in federal tax dollars to open up a strip club. Yeah, in a lawsuit filed last week, D.C. Attorney General said that the Miracle Hands Incorporated, which is an HIV/AIDS service provider, Miracle Hands Incorporated, promised the city it was using the cash to renovate a warehouse to set up a job training center for residents with HIV/AIDS. Instead, the warehouse was turned into the Stadium Club, a strip club that continues to operate as we went to press today. This is over at the Washington Examiner. Miracle Hands Incorporated happens to share an address with Stadium Club. Mm-hmm. Attempts to reach Miracle Hands owner were not successful. Imagine that, from the Washington Examiner. This owner, Cornell Jones, is a self-described former D.C. drug kingpin with convictions for narcotics distribution on his record. And he managed to scam the government out of $300,000 so he could open a strip club and continue his underworld career, funded by, well, you and I and the folks there in Washington, D.C. The grants for renovating the warehouse were first given to Miracle Hands back in 2006, by the District HIV/AIDS Administration. So there's just a hint of where Washington, D.C. is in the swirling, sucking vortex down the toilet. They have an HIV/AIDS administration there in the city. Lots of cousins and nephews of other governing officials make their livings toiling away every day there in the HIV/AIDS Administration in Washington, D.C. What do? They ask. Well, they hand out grants like this one to a drug dealer so he can open a strip club. An inspector general's audit of the HIV/AIDS Administration in D.C. found that during the four-year tenure of the agency's former director, Deborah Rowe, little attention was paid to how the dollars were spent. Okay. And by the way, Deborah Rowe, the former director of DC's HIV/AIDS administration, she was fired in 2008, and she went to work for Miracle Hands Incorporated as its executive director. By the way, she could not be reached for comment either, as the story went to press. I mean, I if you don't laugh about it, you'd want to have somebody strung up in the city square. So you just got to laugh it off and just let it go, because there's not much we can do at this point. But we do wish the D.C. attorney all the best in his lawsuit. No doubt if he loses the lawsuit, he'll probably have an opportunity at a new career with Miracle Hands Incorporated. Then they ask for a grant and go out and build a strip club. Anyway, thank you, Cindy. We really do appreciate that. Let's see here. I want to move out of the politics file for a minute, because we're coming up the end here, and I really want to get... I've got more than I can get to. I hate to do this, but I might run a little bit long from the culture file. This is an update on the story we did last week regarding SpaceX, the private firm. Exploring, how to launch rockets into space so that our astronauts don't have to hitch rides on those Russian death traps. Good news last week, not so much good news this week from the Wall Street Journal. An unmanned spaceship funded by the internet billionaire Jeff Bezos veered out of control and had to be destroyed during a recent test flight, highlighting the risks of private space ventures. Investigators are looking at remnants of the craft recovered on the ground to determine the cause of the crash. The mishap, which industry officials said occurred August 24th, dealt a potentially major blow to the ambitions of Mr. Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com, to develop a reliable system for blasting tourists and astronauts out of the atmosphere. The failure also could set back White House plans to promote commercially developed spacecraft to transport crews to the International Space Station by the second half of this decade. Yeah, the decade. No, didn't you ever hear the speech by John F. Kennedy that we would send a man to the moon and return him safely to the earth in this decade? Yes. Yeah, decade, okay. But yeah, the decade. Let's see here. Championed by President Barry Ho's administration, the goal of this government promotion to develop commercial air spacecraft, the goal is to support a number of rival projects, including this one, to ensure that in the end, the U.S. will have alternatives to reach the space station following July's permanent retirement of the incredibly bloated and overly bureaucratic space shuttle fleet. Anyway, so the government's involved, and they might even be involved in SpaceX. I did not know that. I thought it was private, but it's not, and it's depressing, and now the rocket blew up, and I'm glad I'm not an astronaut looking forward to a ride on one of those Russian Roman candles that they've got over there. But anyways, let's go to the science file. Again from WorldNet Daily. WorldNet Daily making a strong showing this week, bringing something, which they always do. The state-run California Science Center has agreed to pay $110,000 to settle a lawsuit alleging it had censored a two-film debate presentation after it learned one of the films would advocate intelligent design. That's right. So, as a part of the settlement, the California Science Center must now not only pay the American Freedom Alliance $110,000, but also publicly invite the group to return to show the film Darwin's Dilemma. That's the film that first caused the big to-do a couple of years ago. William J. Becker of the Becker Law Firm is the counsel for the American Freedom Alliance, who won the lawsuit because their video, Darwin's Dilemma, was squelched and kept from the public. He's got some quotes here. Well, before we get to Mr. Becker, let me just state what the WorldNet Daily author points out. Intelligent design challenges the fundamental foundation of evolutionary theory, arguing that the complexities of life bear evidence of a designer. I'm okay with that. But why stop there? Who is the designer? Maybe it's aliens. Maybe it's that flying spaghetti monster that the atheists like to bring up. And I guess the intelligent designer... Creationists have been so neutered over this past generation that now the greatest minds of our time can only say that they think they see design. They can't talk about the designer. And this is evidence that the godless have actually won this battle. But I respect these folks for trying to fight back. But I'm a little disappointed that we can talk about the design, but we can't talk about the designer because that's considered unscientific. When in fact, the point of science is, if there is a designer, one of the points of scientific endeavor should be to reveal who that designer is. Because if there is a designer, well, maybe we need to find out what he intended for all this and work within those parameters. Do you think? Maybe. But we're not allowed to say that anymore. Anyway, William Becker, counsel for the American Freedom Alliance, says, quote, "The public should be allowed to make up its own mind whether intelligent design has any merit." Well, that's true enough. That's true enough for adults who maybe were going to be exposed to these two videos. It was a video debate, a two-film debate. There was the film Darwin's Dilemma that was going to be shown, advocating intelligent design. And then there was some other evolutionary movie, which there are a dime a dozen. You can probably find a million of them. But for Mr. Becker, I would like to remind him that when it comes especially to younger people, I mean, Jesus called the public sheep. You remember that from the Bible? That's what he called the masses. He called them sheep. And Mr. Becker, a public... a bunch of sheep educated by godless government bureaucrats and the pop culture will not decide wisely when asked. They'll pick the decision that gives them the least amount of personal responsibility because they're sheep. Jesus said they were sheep. They will not decide wisely. So whereas Mr. Becker thinks that everyone should be allowed to make up their mind, I want to talk to parents out there and tell you, teach your children. Indoctrinate them with the truth of God's special creation about 6,000 years ago, and don't ever back off on that. Because once you back off on that, you set your children up to be confused and possibly to reject their own creator, to reject their own intelligent designer. And so don't leave it to chance and think that they should be allowed to make up their mind. They need to be taught. Most people need to be told what to do. That's what I've found. That's generally true. All right. Now, more into the politics file. From London, WikiLeaks has disclosed its entire archive of U.S. State Department cables. Much of it, if not all, is uncensored. Yeah. And apparently all the newspapers that loved up on WikiLeaks, they're now mad. In a joint statement published on the Guardian's website in London, the statement said that the British publication, along with the New York Times, France's Le Monde, and Germany's Der Spiegel, and Spain's El País, quote, deplore the decision of WikiLeaks to publish the unredacted State Department cables. Why? They say that the unredacted files could jeopardize vulnerable people, such as opposition figures in totalitarian governments. So this could get some people killed. Not that WikiLeaks already hasn't gotten some people killed. But it's kind of ironic that all these liberal media outlets who fell in love with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, now they're finally coming to the realization that this guy could unleash hell and death and fire on an awful lot of people who've been helpful to our side. Yeah, and so now they're going to try to distance themselves now that WikiLeaks has gone rogue, so to speak. Do I want to do anything? I really don't care. I hope they catch Julian Assange and summarily execute him on board a naval craft and dump his body in the sea. And speaking of all that, let's go to AP, Kabul, Afghanistan. NATO and Afghan forces killed a former Guantanamo detainee who had become a key al-Qaeda affiliate after being let go and returning to Afghanistan. Sabar Lal Melma, who was released from Gitmo in 2007 after 5 years of detention, had been organizing attacks in eastern Kunar province and funding insurgent operations, according to NATO. Now, Melma had been detained also for about 5 days back in August of 2011, as recently as August of 2011, but he was let go again. Now, the Pentagon says that 61 detainees, approximately 11% of those released from Guantanamo, had rejoined the jihadist fight against the West over there in the Middle East. About 520 Guantanamo detainees have been released from custody or transferred to prisons elsewhere in the world. That's very disappointing. While imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay, the U.S. determined that this particular fellow, Sabar Lal Melma, they determined that he was a probable facilitator for al-Qaeda members and was also thought to have links to Pakistan's intelligence service. So he should have been summarily executed at Guantanamo Bay, but instead he was inexplicably sent back to Afghanistan in September of 2007. In 2010, then CIA Director Leon Panetta said only 50 to 100 al-Qaeda operatives continue to operate inside of Afghanistan. It's not clear if Panetta was referring to commanders of al-Qaeda or just to foot soldiers. So that was back in 2010 when CIA Director Leon Panetta said that. And, of course, it was in January of 2009 that the whole world asked, why is Leon Panetta in charge of the CIA? As we all let out a collective gasp. Leon Panetta? You got to be kidding me. Wasn't he in charge of, like, hiding chicks for Bill Clinton? How does this guy end up in charge of the CIA? Anyway, but we don't want to lay the disaster of releasing Guantanamo detainees strictly at the foot of the Barry Ho administration and the hapless Leon Panetta. It goes well back into the Bush administration, and it's absolutely deplorable. And it's no way to fight a war if you want to win. All right, more from the war file. In a dramatic turn of events, this is according to Ynet News out of Israel. In a dramatic turn of events, Turkey announced last week that it was expelling the Israeli ambassador from Ankara, from the capital, and that Turkey's diplomatic representation in Israel would be further reduced. Ankara views the Israeli government as responsible for the situation and that Turkey will not revise its position on the matter until Israel reconsiders its stand on the flotilla incident. So there was a report released, an unreport, that was released this past week that basically said Israel was responsible for killing terrorists that were attempting to break the blockade in Gaza. And now Turkey has gone, they've gotten quite upset. And according to the Ynet News article, Turkey does not recognize the legality of the Israeli blockade on Gaza. My throat's getting a little bit scratchy. Bear with me while I take a sip of water here. Yeah. Ankara, that's the Turkish capital. They're also said to be exploring their options against Israel with the International Court of Criminal Justice. The unreport that was released last week does not demand an Israeli apology, establishing instead that Israel should express regret and pay reparations to the terrorists that they injured and killed there on the boat. Sources say that while Turkey may downgrade its ties with Israel, the U.S. is likely to stop Ankara from severing its ties with Jerusalem completely. Well, we'll just see about that, because in a report that was just handed to me, the Obama administration has begun a last-ditch diplomatic campaign to avert a confrontation this month over a Palestinian plan to seek recognition as a state in the United Nations. But according to these authors from LexisNexis, it may already be too late. That's right. The unassembly, the ungeneral assembly, begins on September 20th, and Mahmoud Abbas and the other Palestinians have front and center a vote on Palestinian statehood. Here's what's going on. The State Department last week issued a formal diplomatic message to more than 70 countries. The administration said that the intent of the message was to narrow the majority the Palestinians expect to have in the General Assembly. So it's already a given amongst those in the know at the UN that the vote for Palestinian statehood is a fait accompli. And it's known inside the State Department that it's a fait accompli. And folks, this will be a seismic event. Let's hope the news media covers it more thoroughly than they have the Fast and Furious scandal. Because trouble's brewing in the Middle East. And I know, you could have said that at any time over the last 3,000 years, and you would have been accurate. Trouble is brewing in the Middle East. But it's at a particular point now in history where it could boil over, and the cauldrons could scald the Middle East and Europe, and nay, even right here on our fair shores in America. Here's what's happening off the coast of the Sinai. The Israeli Navy has decided to boost its presence and patrols near the Red Sea. Israeli security forces have put two additional warships and dispatched them into Israel's Red Sea border with Egypt. Another source said that the operation was routine, telling Reuters that two naval craft have been sent to the Red Sea, but this is not unusual. These are not the droids you're looking for. Not unusual at all for Israel to dispatch warships into the Red Sea at a time when Egypt is being overrun by Islamic fundamentalist fanatics controlled by Iran. But these are not the droids you're looking for. Please refer back to the Beyonce story that had your interest, and please ignore this. The area adjacent to the Israeli-Egyptian border has become the scene of a military deployment described by one security source as unprecedented. Yes. Now, Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Haibullah Sarraya, he says that the Islamic Republic of Iran is planning to send its 15th fleet into the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, but of course they're not there to provoke a conflict with the Israelis. They're there to patrol the seas and thwart pirate raids. But the thing is that in Iran, Israel is considered pirates. Yeah, that's right. So they want to thwart pirate raids. That's the thing with the Iranians, is you have to determine what they mean by the word pirate. Yeah. So it's going to be a hard fall. Going to be a hard fall. And I mean, it's going to be a difficult autumn. Yes, a hard fall indeed. But we'll be paying attention. And now, let's go to another story that's not nearly as important, but should be covered. This is from MSN.com. Chaz Bono, the only child of Sonny Bono and Cher, was born a woman, but legally changed his gender and name last year. The announcement Monday that he would join the highly rated ABC dance competition Dancing with the Stars immediately made him one of the highest profile transgendered people in the world. Now, a couple of things here for MSN. To call Chaz Bono is a sin against Chastity Bono. And to refer to Chastity Bono as him is a sin against God and against Chastity Bono that you will be held responsible for. Chastity Bono is a confused woman who has mutilated herself and undergone a transformation that is horrifying. And for you in the mainstream media to call Chastity Bono him is a sin for which you will be held responsible in helping further delude this obviously mentally ill person who needs help, okay? Second of all, I fear for my country when I read that Dancing with the Stars is a highly rated ABC program. I mean, that's just terrifying to me from the perspective of just an American who hopes for the future of the country. That's just depressing. Now, according to MSN, this event of adding Chastity Bono to the Dancing with the Stars, it's brought to the surface prejudices about Bono and others who have mutilated themselves. I'm sorry. Who have changed their gender. All kinds of comments are flying around the Dancing with the Stars message board. But according to the article, for everyone who vented disgust at the prospect of watching Chastity Bono dressed as a boy dancing, there were many who defended Bono and accused his critics of bigotry. Yes, of course. Okay, so if you want to help a mentally disturbed person intent on mutilating their bodies, you're now a bigot. And me, I'm going to throw in my lot with the bigots and hope that at some point, before Chastity Bono passes from the scene, that someone brings her back from the edge. Because I really feel for Chastity. I do. That's it. That's all I've got this week, folks. It's been a wonderful week. I look forward to the next one. I want to thank my friends at KGOV. KGOV.com online at Denver Bible Church, Personhood USA, American Right to Life, and of course, as always, my other brother Darrow, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I will be back with you next week, should the Lord tarry, and until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.